You are listening to a sermon by Henry Neufeld, recorded on Sunday, August 7th, 2011, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Earlier, when Andre was talking about kings and the power of kings, I was reminded of our time in Thailand when there was an election. One of the candidates made a radio speech in which he said that he wished he had been born the son of royalty rather than the son of a rice farmer. For making that statement, he was charged with a crime of lay majesty, an offense against royalty. He was sentenced to 2 years in jail. So, in some countries, kings still have a lot of power. There are two people I want to thank for helping me with this preparation for this talk. Janice Kreider sometimes passes on copies of the Mennonite, which is an American publication, to me. And a few weeks back, she gave us a couple of issues. Included in that was a Mother's Day issue. And in that was an article about subversive women. And I mentioned Shifra and Pua. And at that point, I got quite interested in these two women. And Peter Newdorf provided me with some historical material about the problems that early Anabaptists had with the authorities that resulted in their persecution. So these two women, Pua and Shifra, are women that I was not at all familiar with. And yet here they are, two Jewish midwives, and they had orders from Pharaoh that when a Jewish boy was born, it was to be killed. If it's a girl, they could let her live. Now, our Bible doesn't tell us very much about this edict, except that Pharaoh was worried that the Israelites were having too many babies and they'd soon outnumber the Egyptians. Well, the Israelites at this point had been in Egypt for about 210 years, and the estimates are that there was a minimum of 500,000 Israelites. And the estimates vary anywhere from 500,000 to 2 million. So there were quite a few Israelites. Now the odd thing about this order is that only the male children were to be killed. Now if he wants to control the population, surely it'd be twice as effective if he killed all the children. More about that a bit later. These two midwives were devout Jews, and they disobeyed Pharaoh. They let the boys live. And Pharaoh asked them why. And the midwives, like most of us, when asked the question why, can come up with an answer, either the genuine one or can make one up. Well, Pharaoh wasn't very happy about this, and he issued a new order. Every newborn male child is to be thrown into the Nile River. Not just Jewish children, but all children. So it seems to go beyond the overpopulation concern. Well, at this point, it becomes helpful to consult some of the Jewish writings on this era. Because the Talmud reports that according to Egyptian astrologers, the liberator of the Israelites was soon to be born. In fact, they had narrowed it down to pretty much a specific day when this liberator of the Jews was going to be born. But they didn't know whether he would be Jewish or Egyptian. So this provides another perspective on why this edict was given. You kill only the male children. The male children were a threat to Pharaoh. Jochebed gave birth to a third child, the boy Moses. Now right from the first moment of his birth, it became apparent that he was an extraordinary child. And again, some of this comes from the Jewish writings. For the house at the time of his birth was filled with radiant light. His parents tried everything possible to prevent his falling into the hands of Pharaoh's men, because they were continuously looking for Jewish children, male children that should be killed. After 3 months, Jochebed saw that she would not be able to conceal Moses. And so she makes this waterproof basket in which she puts Moses and sets him in the papyrus reeds on the Nile. And she returns home. But Moses' sister Miriam sticks around to watch to see what's going to happen. By the way, I was impressed, Veronica, that you found a hymn that mentions both Moses and Miriam. That's amazing. So King Pharaoh's daughter comes down the river along with her maids to take a bath. She hears the crying child, finds a basket, an infant, and in it the boy Moses. So she's intrigued by the child's beauty, and she tries to figure out a way to keep him for herself and save him from death. She knew that this boy was one of the children born to a Jewish family and condemned to death. She took the child home. Now, Moses, now about 3 months old, refused to be nursed by any of the Egyptian maids-in-waiting, and he continues to cry. So Miriam, Moses' sister, comes to the princess and says, well, how about if I find you a Jewish nurse who would nurse the baby so long as you want? And Bithia was glad of this solution. Miriam rushes home and brings back Moses' mother, whom she introduced as an experienced nurse. And for 2 years, Moses' mother, in the royal household, cares for this child. Meanwhile, Bithia tells Pharaoh about the boy that she had found and adopted. Now, he did not object because his astrologers told him that the boys that would have been a threat were born at an earlier time and they've all been killed. So this kid is not a threat. So Moses was taken to the royal court. He grew up as an adopted son of King Pharaoh's daughter. He grew up as a prince in a royal household. The two midwives, Shifra and Pua, play a critical part in the story of Moses and the redemption from Egypt. If these two midwives had simply done their job, if they had followed orders, Moses would have been killed as soon as he was born. And the destiny of the Jewish people would have been profoundly altered if they had done what they were ordered to do. Well, thank God, they didn't. When this decree came along, Shifra and Pua could have taken an easy way out. They could have resigned from their jobs. If they resigned, they would avoid risking the wrath of Pharaoh or be faced with the distasteful task of killing babies. But they didn't dodge their responsibility. They stayed in their jobs, they defied Pharaoh's orders, and they saved Jewish babies, including Moses. Now, quite possibly, this is the first act of civil disobedience for religious reasons in history. The Torah tells us, or the Bible tells us as well, that they took this faith because they were in awe of God. What makes Shifra and Pua so special is that without regard to their personal safety, they did what they believed God wanted them to do. They resisted the tyranny of Pharaoh, and instead they chose to do the right thing. If they hadn't acted as they did, there would not have been any Moses, and there wouldn't have been the rest of the Exodus story. The Israelites might still be in Egypt, spiritually, if not physically. Well, it's only very recently that I heard of these two women, and I've never heard a sermon about them. But Jewish people pay a lot more attention to the Old Testament than we do. And in the 1960s, a rabbi at Brandeis University established the Shifra and Pua Award to be given annually to recognize nonviolent resistance to tyranny. The Pua Institute in Brooklyn advertises itself as experts in the world of fertility. It's a fine tribute to this early midwife who saved Moses' life. These two women are acknowledged in the Jewish community for their civil obedience. They chose to obey God rather than man. So, from these midwives, we can learn a lesson about courage, civil disobedience, and creative nonviolent action to make their point. We can learn to stand up for what is right, even though it may be personally hazardous. And that's a lesson our world needs. What we have here are stories of cunning midwives, secretive mothers, and a brazen princess. We have stories of subversive women. And history is full of examples of civil disobedience, and I want to cite a few. The early Anabaptists practiced civil disobedience. They refused to have their children baptized. Infant baptism gave them membership in the church and in the state. It gave them citizenship. This meant unbaptized children were stateless. Everyone had to be a member of the church and state. The idea of separation of church and state, which we take for granted, was quite new at the time. And the Anabaptist position resulted in them becoming enemies of the state and the church, and it resulted in massive persecution and many deaths. Civil disobedience can be risky. And Peter Neuter gave me a book, Profiles of Anabaptist Women of the 16th Century, quite a volume about martyrs from that time. In the U.S., the American philosopher Henry David Thoreau was a war tax resister. In the 1840s, he refused to pay 6 years of taxes because of his opposition to the Mexican-American War. As a result, he spent a night in prison. He was freed the following day when his aunt paid taxes on his behalf. And there's an apocryphal story about Ralph Waldo Emerson visiting Thoreau in jail. And Emerson says to Thoreau, what are you doing here? And Thoreau replies, Ralph, what are you doing out there? Well, this experience left a deep impression on Thoreau, and in 1849 he published an essay entitled Civil Disobedience. In this essay, Thoreau argues that people should not permit governments to overrule their conscience. Remarkable. He argues that acquiescence enables the government to make people agents of injustice. There are some other examples of disobedience in history. There was a family in the World War II time that sheltered Anne Frank. There were the Lutherans in the French village of Le Chambon who harbored and rescued Jews. And then there was Paul Leatherman, an MCC worker working for Vietnam Christian Service in Vietnam in the 1970s. He was questioned about offering aid indiscriminately during the Vietnam War. He said, when people come for assistance, we don't ask to see their identification or ask their political persuasion. When it was pointed out to him that he was assisting Viet Cong and that this was a treason, Leatherman responded that there is no treason in the church. We help all those who come for help. So these were subversive people in the pattern of Pua and Shifra. They took risks, and they are needed today. There are some things I wonder about. Where are the subversive women and men like Pua and Shifra today? Where are the people who will say enough is enough and take action? Where were the Christian voices in our recent federal election? No one questioned why Canada is presently involved in two wars. No politician talked about that reality, as far as I know. And neither did the churches. How come they were silent? In your bulletin, on the last page, is a form. It's called a peace tax return. It's put out by Conscience Canada. And if you want to get the complete form and other forms that they produce, Google Conscience Canada. It will provide this information.
There's also a link for Mennonite Church Canada's.
Is it? Yeah, okay. And so this is simply a form that you can send in with your income tax or separately. to oppose the taxes that are going to pay for war. And it's something that you might want to think about and consider. This is not an act of civil disobedience. You're not breaking any law by doing this. You're simply expressing your opinion. So I want to close with that quote that Andre read, and I want to read it once more, from Stanley Hauerwas. Growth in the Christian life may well involve encouraging a greater conflict between the self and wider society. Christians should train their children to resist the authority of the state, not in the name of rights as individuals, but because the justice of the state is to be judged against God's justice. Please remember Pua and Shifra and their civil disobedience.